All right, could you all have a seat and we can start? If you sit in the very back, you might not be able to see this, so I'd encourage you to move up a bit so you can read this. As you can see by the title, this isn't very long because it's 209 seconds that will make you question everything. So I'm going to play this and then we'll talk about how this leads into our study. So, you look at your notes there. So the last 30 years have left Christians feeling somewhat uncomfortable as we learn more and more about the size of the universe as well as the age of the universe. We see the immensity of the universe and we compare it to how tiny we are, not just people, but the earth itself. And so Genesis 1 teaches us that man is the center of creation. Man is the high point. And yet when you think about how vast the universe is, that's a little bit unnerving. C.S. Lewis talks about, he had atheist friends who would say to him, all right, stare at that dot called Earth. How do you convince yourself that the God who created the whole universe will help you when you ask? How can you possibly believe in a God who would waste an entire universe just for you? So we have this vast universe, and yet from the Bible's perspective, God seems to only care comparatively about us. And so the atheist would challenge Lewis on the vastness of the universe. Carl Sagan was no friend of Christianity, but he wrote, in some respects, science has far surpassed religion in delivering awe. How is it that hardly any major religion has looked at science and concluded, this is better than we thought? The universe is much bigger than our prophets said, grander, more subtle, more elegant. God must be even greater than we dreamed. Instead, they say, oh, no, 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 my God is a little God, and I want him to stay that way. A religion old or new that stressed the magnificence of the universe as revealed by modern science might be able to draw forth reserves of reverence and awe hardly tapped by conventional faiths. Sooner or later, such a religion will emerge. What is Sagan saying here? He's saying the Christian church has not been able to answer or appreciate what we've discovered. Instead of being awed by it, they seem to be almost embarrassed by it or concerned about it, how to answer that question. So when you go to any type of website, like atheist.com used to be a common website. If you ask atheists what's the number one reason they don't believe in God or Christianity, it's usually modern science is how they'll answer that. They'll say modern science disproves the Bible, especially Genesis 1 and 2, which has the earth and creation of us as the center of this vast universe. And so if we are the center, why did God waste time with all these billions of other planets and stars that we can't even see? Well, we can with more and more with a Hubble, but, you know, for ages. And so both the vastness of the universe, as we've discovered it, and the age of the universe. Because the more we study, the more we realize how far back it goes, more than we thought, has left Christians, some Christians, a bit uncomfortable. So have you ever either read that or experienced that before? Go ahead, Christy. Oh, yeah. You felt it or you've heard that before? Both? Oh. Now, obviously, there's nothing in Genesis 1 or 2 that says the universe is not vast. And we've already looked at it. There's nothing about the age of the universe either. But it's still, the discoveries have left Christians who have held on to a certain model a bit uncomfortable. So I would suggest to you that grappling is actually in the Bible. that grappling with how large the universe is compared to how tiny we are. Psalm 8, when I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars, which you have set in place, what is mankind that you are mindful of them, human beings that you care for them? So here the psalmist is grappling with the problem, isn't he? He's looking up, and even what he could see is just our galaxy, the stars. He says, who are we that you should care about us? We're these tiny, insignificant little creatures in this vast universe. So that amazement is actually in the Psalms. Isaiah 40:22, he sits enthroned above the circle of the earth, and its people are like grasshoppers. He stretches out the heavens like a canopy and spreads them out like a tent to live in. So even from God's perspective, we are like grasshoppers. We are tiny little things. So we get a glimpse from above. And if we feel that, if we feel, who are we in this vast universe? Well, the Bible asks the question too. It says, you're like grasshoppers. And then 1 Kings 8:27, but will God really dwell on earth? The heavens, even the highest heaven, cannot contain you. How much less this temple I have built. Who wrote this? Solomon. Solomon says, could I really put the God who created this cosmos in a building? How could God, who cannot even be contained in this cosmos, be contained in a building? So even Solomon knew that this was only a picture of something greater, that God couldn't actually be here in that localized sense. And so there's no reason to deny billions of galaxies. The Bible, even from the perspective of what they see, is in awe with the vastness of the universe compared to us. And so the more we learn how vast the universe is, what should that make us more? Filled with awe of the Lord. That's where the Bible is going. So modern science should only increase our awe of God. I mean, when I was a kid, I don't think we knew all this. Some of you, right? How vast the universe was. Typically, our Milky Way was kind of what you learned, the planets and what's beyond. Now we're learning that even that's nothing in what we see. Now, you could say it's a grand conspiracy and all the pictures are fake, but you don't want to go there, right? They are real. So any thoughts on the vastness of the universe before we get to the age, which probably is even more problem? Yes, true. Right. Yeah, in Genesis 1, it's the sun, moon, and the stars, or the greater light, lesser light, oh, and everything else. And that's only really in reference to what we can see, too, right? Yes, Chrissy. Yeah, Sagan is probably reacting to more conservative Christianity, isn't he? That seems to want to explain away instead of having a God that fits the awe that science is seeing. I think Sagan starts one of... What was Sagan's show that used to be on every week? What is it? The Cosmos. I think he starts it with a negative view that there's no God, this is all there is. Didn't he start? All right, that's really old, but anyway. And so the Bible itself grapples with the size of the universe even then, and grapples with this idea that God could care for us, that we could be the most important in this vast universe that he's created. That builds awe. And so it should build on us, but even more, because we now know it's much bigger than even they knew. But then there's the age of the universe and the earth, which is the more we learn, the more we find out it's older and older than we thought. The Bible does not suggest, I hope you've seen this in the last 2 months, a young earth or universe. The problem, of course, is Bishop Usher, very famous in the 17th century, he said the earth was formed in 4004 BC. Now, where did he get that from? Somebody know? Yeah, he added up all the years in the genealogies. So he made some assumptions there. First, he assumed the genealogies don't have gaps, which they do, because even Jesus' genealogies in the New Testament have gaps. So Jesus can be the son of David, but he's obviously not the direct son of David. He's the indirect son of David. But also he's assuming that when the genealogies start, that's when the earth began, which we've already said, that's not what Genesis 1 teaches. So you had this idea from guys like Bishop Unser that Usher became more prominent, that the earth is young. But then when the evidence came in that the earth is much older, Christians were uncomfortable. I mean, we have cave paintings from more than 20,000 BC. And so there's just no way the earth can only be 4,000 or mankind 4,000 years old. We have 250,000 species that have gone extinct. And no, Adam did not have to fear dinosaurs. They were long, long gone when Adam and Eve were there. Can you imagine this beautiful paradise? Oh, by the way, there's dinosaurs all over here. Right. And so the more we learn of the vastness and the age, it's not doing what it should, which is draw us to and be in awe of God. It's making Christians reactionary and uncomfortable. So the fear is that the age of the earth diminishes God, because what makes us uncomfortable is, why would God take millions of years to make an earth? For some reason, that makes us uncomfortable. When, why should it? Now, we know that it doesn't take him in the sense of he needs it. God can do anything. It's never an argument, well, God's limited. But for some reason, age makes Christians uncomfortable. But notice Psalm 90 again, thinking of the age of things, draws awe. Before the mountains were born, or you brought forth the whole world, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. You turn people back to dust, saying, return to dust, you mortals. 1,000 years in your sight are like a day that has just gone by, or like a watch in the night. A watch in the night is a few hours. 1,000 years to God is like a few hours. And so the psalmist considers everlasting. So what would 1,000,000 years or 100,000,000 years be to everlasting? It'd be nothing, right? That's what the psalmist says. Billions of years would be like nothing to someone who's existed eternally. And so in the Psalms, it draws more praise and awe to think back. Now, that raises the common question, well, if the earth is that old, then there must have been death before the fall. Well, yeah, there are animals died before the fall, because when Adam and Eve died, it was mankind who was sentenced to death. Thomas Aquinas, throughout the Middle Ages, this was common, believed that God's original creation included animals that killed each other. He wrote, the nature of animals was not changed by man's sin. So the common view of the young earth creationists is that all death began with Adam, which means there couldn't have been an old earth. But that is not what the Bible actually teaches. One pastor wrote, there had to be death in the garden, otherwise Adam would have been overrun by bugs and bacteria long before he took that forbidden bite of fruit. So another way this has been asked, did Adam step on an ant in the garden? You ever hear it that way? Is it possible to live in this world with tiny creatures and have a human being with a real body and not kill anything? So what's interesting is those who want to hold to a young earth say that when Adam fell, God changed the nature of animals. In other words, they weren't carnivores because there was no death. But then Adam fell, and now animals are carnivores. There'll be death. But then you have the problem of two creations, don't you? You have God creating and then sort of recreating a whole different type of species. But notice Psalm 104. Psalm 104 is a creation psalm. Notice it goes back to the 6 days of Genesis. He made the moon to mark the seasons, and the sun knows when to go down. You bring darkness, it becomes night, and all the beasts of the forest prowl. The lions roar for their prey and seek their food from God. So right there, back in Genesis, the first creation of the animals, they're already looking for prey. They're carnivores. There's not a reconstituting of their natures after the fall. And Psalm 104 is all about before the fall, all about creation. All right, thoughts or questions? Yes, Ken. Yeah, the lion and the lamb is eschatological. It's looking to the new heavens and earth. It's not describing what already is. The lion will lie down with the lamb. So that would be a misuse. And the appearance of age has so many problems to it. You actually have God deceiving us in many ways. But the Bible doesn't teach an appearance with age. I mean, appearance of age. So when we see evidence in modern science of how old the earth is, the common argument for young earth, well, it can't be old because that means there would be death. And death started at the garden. And our response should be death started for God's image bearers in the garden, not for other creatures or amoebas or bacteria or plants died, right, too. And so there's nothing in the Bible that says the earth can't be millions and millions of years old. So remember, Genesis 1 is not an exhaustive description of creation. We're not told that God created bacteria or the air. The air is not listed as one of the creations. Nor is it a scientific or chronological description. It's not a scientific order. We've already looked at that. And then also remember, the cosmology of Genesis 1 is the cosmology the Israelites saw. It's from their viewpoint. It's not from our modern scientific viewpoint, which wouldn't make any sense to them. And we talked about all the early church fathers and Calvin and all who said this, that God was condescending to their understanding. We see that, of course, with the mustard seed, right? The smallest seed is the mustard seed. Scientifically, not true, right? But in their understanding, it was true. And God didn't give them science that they couldn't even understand. The point wouldn't make any sense. So, for example, we see that this phrase in Genesis, the windows of heaven opened up and it rained. Is the Lord describing cosmology here? That there are windows in heaven? Or what's he describing? If it's not scientific chronology that there are windows in heaven, what's the language describing? It's describing how people saw it. It looks as if windows open up. They didn't have an evaporative cycle understanding back in the ancient world. So they weren't thinking, well, you know, the water evaporates up and we all went to school and we have the whole cycle. So in their mind, the heavens opened up. And so windows of heaven was a common way to talk about it, just like the sun rising, right? The sun rising is not scientifically accurate, but it's what we see. So the Bible uses that language also. All this to say is there's nothing about the vastness or the age that modern science is discovering that's a threat to the Bible. It's only a threat if you've misunderstood the Bible, like Bishop Usher did in the 17th century. Yes, Jonathan. Right, that's the question. How do you know what is metaphorical, what is... And just like with any language, Scripture interprets Scripture. The more you read about it, the more you see. Because we're going to see Genesis 2 gives us a different order from Genesis 1. In Genesis 2, man is created first and then plants. Genesis 1, it's the opposite. So scripture itself is showing us this is not a chronological order in Genesis 1. That's not the point. So yeah, just with language. And we're going to get to Adam in the next 2 weeks. We're going to talk about the creation of man and woman from the two different Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. So a couple of very interesting quotes. Alan Sandage, Dr. Sandage, was a believer in divine design. He was an assistant to Edwin Hubble. And that should tell you what? The Hubble telescope, right? Science, and this goes with what Christy just said earlier. Science is concerned with the what, when, and how. It does not, and indeed cannot, answer within its method, powerful as that method is, why. So we talked about in our introduction that some Christians, the reason they reject modern science is because some scientists speak, and what they're speaking is more opinion. But it's not the science that's opinion. If it's established, it's their opinion of it. And they go out of their lane without admitting it. So here's an honest scientist who's saying, science cannot answer the question of who made this. Science can only answer the question of how did it develop or when. Stephen Hawking, again, no friend of Christianity, although science may solve the problem of how the universe began, it cannot answer the question, why does the universe bother to exist? I don't know the answer to that. Now, isn't that nice to see that humility where he's... So sometimes we think because scientists answer theological questions, like, well, evolution proves that there's no God. Evolution doesn't say anything about who made this, who started it. It's a whole different thing. But then we say, okay, whatever he says must be wrong. But he simply has stepped out of his lane. So Hawking was humble enough to say, nothing that I study in science tells me if there's a God. Now, Romans 1 would say, the evidence of God is in the science. It's all around you. The vastness, the beauty, the wisdom. You see God's character. These things cannot happen by accident. Robert Jastrow, a NASA scientist, this is a great quote. For the scientist who has lived by his faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He has scaled the mountains of ignorance. He is about to conquer the highest peak. And as he pulls himself over the final rock, he is greeted by a band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries. So if the scientist thinks, I'm going to discover the great meaning of life through science, after all his study, and he realizes theologians have been explaining this forever, the great meaning of life that science does point to. Any thoughts on these quotes? Yes. This is Ian, by the way, if you haven't met Ian. Yeah, it's a good question. Which one do you use, special or general revelation, science or the Bible? And the answer is both. Because sometimes we realize science reveals, as with Galileo, that we misinterpreted a passage. And so science can help us understand a passage. The idea that only special revelation has priority doesn't really work, because how do you even know what the words of the Bible mean? Well, someone taught you to read. The Bible didn't teach you to read. So you're even using general revelation to interpret special revelation. And so you use each other, but obviously the Bible's going to be ultimate. But you have to be open to general revelation, correcting any possible misunderstanding of the Bible. But then where the Bible's clear, then we stick with the Bible, obviously. Yes. Yeah. Now, one of the things we didn't look at, because we're going to save it for Noah's Ark, is what are these kinds? The animals are created in kinds. How do we understand that? But since we have to answer the question, how did all the kinds fit on the ark? We'll save that for Genesis 6. But we're finishing Genesis 1. Next week, we're obviously going to do the creation of man and woman. But and like we don't have time to go through. I hope we've given you a just general way to approach Genesis 1, the six-day literary framework that's given, with the theme being God is the one resting on the seventh day over it all. And the polemics of it, remember? That this would have opened up their eyes to what the other Gentile nations and their all their gods, how different it was. Yes. One that comes to mind is John Collins, Science and Faith. Collins, is he still? He was a professor at Covenant Seminary, I think. He's also a scientist. But that's a good book on this. Yes, Millie. Yeah, it's coming up. Yes. Other thoughts? Is it nice to know that we don't have to be afraid of science as Christians? Unfortunately, the church really recently has been more in fear than in awe of the discoveries. Yes. I think a lot of us can relate to what you just said in our own lives. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, especially in the big city, you can't even see stars, let alone anything else. Yeah. Randy. Yeah, it reminds me of my Greek professor, Dr. Ba, used to say, a fundamentalist is someone who refuses to look at any scripture twice. I know what it means. I know what it says. And I don't want to study it anymore. I don't want to consider. But yeah, that humility to say, yeah, I may have been wrong. Yeah. All right, well, let's go ahead and pray.